Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. The guest this week is Tommy Dunbar of the Ruba News. They've got a brand new album out and almost 50 years in show business. This is a band whose early singles I heard on New York City radio as a teenager, and they really knocked me out. They were sort of this wonderful breath of pop fresh air in the midst of a strange time in music. There was so much disco and kind of over-the-top pretentious album music, and then these kind of new bands popped in, and this one had so much about what I loved about AM radio in it, in a way that a lot of new wave music didn't. So Ruba News really filled a place in my heart. So new record, you'll hear a little bit of it after this interview. I also wanted to mention one more thing. I don't think I've mentioned it on the podcast, and it's important. My daughter has a new single out. You can go listen to it by going to michaelshelley.net/juniper, or go to Amazon or wherever you want to listen to music, Spotify, whatever. But totally worth having a listen to. She's 14 years old, number one hit single, I guarantee it. That's all you need to know. Tommy Dunbar here of the Ruba News. Okay, there are the Ruba News, and on the telephone, I believe, Tommy Dunbar of the Ruba News. Good morning. Welcome to WFMU. How are you?
Good morning, WFMU. I've had my coffee. I'm fine.
Excellent. New record from home. Very exciting. But before we get into that, very first thing first, I want to thank you for last year. You donated a version of Sheena is a Punk Rocker to our fundraising CD, Super Hits of the 70s. And so for that, you are in my eternal good books for eternity.
Oh, well, thank you, man. It's our pleasure.
Yeah, really fun version of that. You and John Rubin have been playing together since what year?
1970. So next year it's going to be 50 years for the Ruba News.
But you sound so young and youthful, I can only assume that you guys were literally kids.
We were 13, I guess, and just about to turn 14 when we started the band, which was, you know, we were going to kind of a hippie school in Berkeley, and we were going to have a hop, a Bay High hop, and that's why we started the band, just because, you know, we needed a band for the dance, and that was the beginning of it all.
The band is known for amazing harmony. Was that apparent right away that you and John could sing together so well?
God, no. I could send you some tapes, we used to practice in Ralph's garage, and there's a few. I think the first one we tried to actually do three-part harmony on was Book of Love by the Monotones, and, it was sufficiently hideous, but, you know, we just kept at it. I mean, as I was saying to somebody the other day, you know, we started out playing oldies and almost kind of looking down our nose at them because this was 1970. And, you know, so we're listening to records from the 50s, which we were loving because my brother had given me all the Cruisin' albums for Christmas the year before. And, you know, we were just way into those. But at the same time, you know, we'd hear the twanky guitar sounds, like even on, you know, Chuck Berry records or something, and think it was kind of, you know, like silly sounding. But then you start trying to play those songs and you realize, you know, why do we sound so foul compared to the record, you know? And it starts to give you a healthy respect. And so we started trying to do some of the songs, like, you know, I remember trying to do It's All Right by the Impressions, you know, and we're just going, why do our vocals sound so foul compared to those? And, you know, we just kept at it and kept trying to learn, you know, what was going on harmonically behind the vocals. Like, you know, we'd be trying to do Chiffon songs or, maybe like Locomotion by Little Eva. You know, so just trying to learn how to do background vocals and do harmony, and you know, just kept at it.
So you just you learned the hard way by just doing it for yeah. I once heard an interview with Brian Wilson, and the interview said, "Well, you guys sound so good." And he said, "Yeah, we practice a lot."
Yeah, that's our mantra, and you know, we used to practice 5 days a week and then play on the weekends, and that's been the super fun thing about this new record is that we actually got to rehearse a lot before we went in the studio, you know, and can't overstate how important rehearsal is for making things, you know, run easily in the studio.
You guys, long story short, your brother Robbie was in a popular Bay Area band called Earthquake, and he sort of helped you guys get started, and a lot of gigs opening for him, and he ends up on Berserkly Records, and so do you guys. First single, 1975. You're still teenagers at this time. What were your expectations? Were you expecting the world to just open up at your feet, or what, was it more modest?
God, I don't know. I don't know about the expectations, but I'll say, yeah, watching Robbie's band was just major for us. You know, I mean, as an influence. I mean, I know for me personally, it was watching. I mean, these are, you know, pre-Berserkly, they did two albums on A&M. And if you listen to the A&M albums, you can really hear, I mean, our vocals sound a lot like their vocals sounded then. And I was, you know, I was watching Robbie, and for me, it was kind of like, oh, this is how it's done. But as far as the Berserkly thing, when they lost their deal with A&M, that's when they started the label. And, you know, first they put out a couple singles. There was Mistress Security, and then they did Friday on My Mind, and that was getting play. And then when it came time to doing the Berserkly Chartbusters album, they asked us to come in and do, you know, one song. And, you know, meanwhile, we were playing with Jonathan Richman, which is why we are on, you know, two of the songs of his on that album.
Were you backing him live at that point?
Yeah. Because he had just come out from Boston. He needed a band. So, you know, three of the Rubinews were, you know, following him around doing just little gigs and stuff. I don't know how long that lasted.
He's such an unusual guy. And I know that I've spoken to him. He doesn't really enjoy his experience at Berserkly. I guess financially, he's a little bitter.
Yeah, I mean, we all had a little bit of weird, you know, things happen there that we weren't super happy about. But, you know, I don't want to, I mean, that's way water under the bridge.
Yeah, but musically, it must have been very unusual and fun to be a 19-year-old backing Jonathan Richman.
Absolutely. No, I mean, Jonathan, I think, was a big influence on us. Just one thing was just the way that he really, you know, has always followed his own compass or whatever you want to call it. You know, and just to watch, I don't know, his attitude towards music also. I mean, and his sense of humor is fantastic. Don, the drummer, and I were just talking about, Don was playing with him, I don't know what it was, back in the 80s maybe or something. And they were in Australia, and Jonathan was doing an interview where they had a bunch of press people, like, sitting in chairs, you know, one of those. And Jonathan had Don and Leroy, who was playing guitar, you know, raise their hands and say, yes, we're from Popular Explosives magazine, and we're just wondering how you feel about the new, you know, F-80s. You know, how do you feel? And Jonathan's going, well, you know, I feel like the expansion rate on the F-80, the new F-80 is, you know, just miles beyond the original one, and they really should have called it the F-81. You know? All these other reporters are looking like, what the hell is going on here? But, I mean, just being around Jonathan was great. And, well, in all the bands, you know, it was a very, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie in Berserkly at that time. And, you know, certainly for us, having Earthquake take us under their wing was a major thing, you know.
Yeah. So tell me, it's so interesting to me that you guys started in 1970, a time when music was transitioning. But by the time your first I guess I Think We're Alone Now was a single in 76, the album in 77. And music is now transitioning again. Were you guys feeling all of that, or were you just, I don't know, we're just going to do our own Rubinews thing?
Yeah, I don't think we were paying too much attention. I mean, I remember us, we were not crazy about what was on the radio at the time. You know, more we were getting into like 50s and 60s stuff. I mean, especially with, you know, the more vocal groups. So, yeah, I don't think we were really paying attention to trends, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
I mean, also, we were growing up in Berkeley where, I mean, a lot of the fact that we were doing pop music sort of felt almost like rebellious for us, because a lot of people, I think, really looked down their noses at the fact that we were doing pop at that time. You know what I mean? I mean, we just weren't heavy enough or, you know, jazz enough or funk enough or, you know, because that's mostly what was going on in Berkeley at the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting to go the other direction and kind of, yeah, it's hip to be cool or
yeah,
square or whatever it is. So could you feel the sort of new wave thing coming on? Because in a way, that sort of served you well when that label came around.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I do remember there seeming to be a lot of bands kind of, you know, hearkening back to the 60s at that time. You know, like I remember going to see Dwight Twilley or something and thinking, yeah, this, you know, this is pop.
Yeah, it's very interesting because you guys sort of you are really known for this kind of amalgam of this absorption of 50s and 60s stuff, but with a new spin on it, which I guess a lot of people always have reacted to. And there was definitely a place for that really hadn't been filled much. Singles from the first couple of records did pretty well. I Think We're Alone Now and I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, obviously a huge hit. And really, it's a number one hit song as far as I'm concerned. When you wrote I Want to Be Your Boyfriend, did you think, okay, now I've done it, I've cracked the code, look out, this is going to...
Oh, God, not at all. I mean, you know, it was like, well, here's another song.
Really?
But it did feel like we got, you know... I mean, in those days, you know, we were playing every weekend, and like I said, we were rehearsing 5 days a week, so it was sort of like we were always introducing new material to the audiences, and, you know, you would notice one song got a big reaction, and another song was sort of like ho-hum, you know what I mean? And you could also just feel it on stage, like you're playing, and, oh, this feels really good to play in front of an audience, and, oh, this one just, you know, it's not exciting.
Yeah.
So that would fall by the wayside, you know.
So
what I mean?
you didn't think it was going to be a hit, but the crowd reaction told you differently.
Well, I remember, you know, a few people saying, "Oh, I really like that one," or, you know, I mean, there were a few songs where we would get that reaction to, you know, from friends or whatever, and then there were other ones where we could just tell playing it where, you know, it was like, this one's okay, but
yeah.
We're not feeling like it's knocking anything else out of the set. You know what I mean?
Yeah, songs that you only when you got to play three sets, you dig those songs out. Yeah, but
yeah.
I'm surprised that I Want to Be Your Boyfriend didn't blow your own mind when you wrote it. Let me remind everybody that Tommy Dunbar is our guest today, and I know we've got folks living in the West Coast who are listening. You've got a gig today, kind of a record release at the Amoeba Store in Berkeley, California, 3 p.m. this afternoon. That's, of course,
that's right,
Berkeley time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure lots of songs from the new album, which is called From Home, and folks can get information about all of this over at rubinews.com. I want to talk about opening for
actually, yeah. I hate to admit it, but our website has almost no information on it. Our Facebook page is probably a little more current.
Let's talk about these 56 dates opening for Elvis Costello during the Armed Forces tour. His band was just on fire, red hot at that time. Was he a fan?
No kidding.
Hey, how did you get that gig? And tell me what that experience was like.
I believe they wanted to hire Greg Kinn. And Greg was already booked to do stuff or something. I mean, there was some reason. I mean, I can't imagine they wouldn't have wanted to do that tour. But then they offered us to them. And they, I think, knew about us because we were getting some attention in England already. And they said, sure, yeah, we'll take those guys. That'd be fine. But for us, I mean, what an amazing experience. I mean, if for no other reason than just watching Elvis's band every night.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're one of our favorite bands. So that was kind of incredible, you know.
We started off earlier in the show. I played the Rubinu song, That Thing You Do. Was that a song written for that film?
Yeah. I got a call actually just saying, oh, these guys are looking for a song for this movie. What is it now? They're kind of like a Beatle band. And they said, yeah, if you could just write something that's kind of Beatle-ish, like, you know, it's like, well, Losing the Sky with Diamonds? What are you talking about? Yeah, and they said, no, like early Beatles, you know, I mean, think almost Hamburg, but, you know, a little bit later. I mean, think, you know, first couple albums. And so just whip that one together and then, you know, sent it over. And then we heard, well, they really liked your song, but they liked the one by Fountains of Wayne better. So that's the one that's going in. And, you know, hearing Fountains of Wayne's That Thing You Do, I go, yeah, you know, I can see why they chose that one. It's really good. So, but yeah, it was written for the film.
The brand new album is called From Home, produced by Chuck Prophet, and it's out yesterday on the Yep Rock Records label. 50 years, a long time, but you guys are still young enough to not be an oldies act. Tell me about making this record. How was it different from previous efforts, or what's changed?
Well, several things. One was just, you know, working with Chuck was fantastic. He and I wrote all the songs together. And I guess to back up on that, Chuck was also a Berkeley kid, but he's about 5 years younger than us, and we knew him, you know, kind of as that kid we would see at the guitar store, and also he was in, you know, a few bands that sometimes we would play with at the Keystone Berkeley and stuff like that. And so anyway, he was that kid. You know, we didn't know him real well. And maybe 10 years later or whatever, our friend Gary Phillips, who was the guy who produced our first two albums, was also a guitar player in Earthquake, would send me these CDs with just stuff he'd been listening to, you know. And every once in a while, there'd be a Chuck Prophet song on there. And every time I would hear one, I'd go, oh, my God, that's, like, really good. And, you know, that's that kid? He's doing this? Fantastic, you know. So then cut to, you know, a couple decades later, and I went to see Chuck play when he came around Sacramento, where I live, and it was just great. And I was talking to him after the show. It's like, oh, my God, you know, I love your songs. The band sounds great. And then cut to a year later, and he's back through, you know, coming somewhere near Sacramento, went to see him again. So we'd always, at the end of the show, talk and say, oh, we should write together sometime. But you know how that is. Yeah, we should get together sometime for a drink. You know, but then Chuck actually called and said, we got to get something on the books. And you know, he's one of the most proactive people I've ever met, which, you know, we really appreciate. And so I drove down to San Francisco. We got together at his place and knocked out two of the songs that are on the album the first day. So, you know, I think we both went, well, this worked out well. Let's, you know, let's do it again. So we got another date on the books for a couple of weeks later, and he came up to Sacramento, and we knocked out another couple of songs. And so, you know, not all the songs we were writing were necessarily, we were thinking Rubinu's, but we were just writing, you know. And but it soon became apparent that, you know, a lot of these seem like they could certainly be Rubinu's tunes. And then I guess it was maybe like 6 months later, we were touring Spain, and I remember getting an email from him saying, I talked to these guys at this label, Yep, that, you know, I have stuff coming out on Yep. And I was telling him about the band, and they might be interested in reissuing some of your early stuff. And so we're writing back, you know, we're in the lobby of some hotel going, yeah, sure, sounds great, whatever, put us in touch. And I don't think Yep knew who we were, really, and we didn't really know who they were. But he really put this deal together, you know. So, I mean, all hats off to Chuck for, you know, making this happen. And I have to say that the other thing is being with the label has been great, because this is a first in a long time, and just having enough budget to where we could get together to rehearse was a major thing. You know, just the fact we could actually, because John lives in Los Angeles, I live in Sacramento, the other guys live closer to the Bay. And so every time we were going to do a gig, we get together to rehearse, you know, because we love rehearsing for one thing, but just also to, you know, knock the cobwebs off. But for this, you know, we did several weeks of rehearsing, and just that's very different than going in the studio and going, well, we'll figure it out when we get in there, or, you know, sometimes having to do it piecemeal where, you know, not all the vocalists are in the room at the same time. I mean, this record was very much done, everybody playing at the same time and all four guys singing around one mic, you know. So that's been very different.
Yeah, and when you play with guys for this long, I assume there is like a telegraphed, almost, you know, like when, like brothers or twins, you just must be
very
able to,
much. Yeah. I mean, yeah, family, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's.
I want to play this amazing song called "Honey from the Honeycombs," a fantastic girl drummer, of course.
Honey Lantry.
How did that? We had actually Martin Murray of the Honeycombs on the show. I don't know, maybe 10 years ago.
Oh man!
Always loved that band. Tell me how you just said I want to write a song about this lady.
Well, actually, the way that came about is we were Chuck and John and I were over sort of doing some really rough little demos at his friend Kelly Stoltz's place. And on the wall was a Burns guitar, and John pointed at it and was saying to Chuck, oh, man, Burns guitars, you know. The Honeycombs all played Burns guitars. And so the next time Chuck and I got together to write, he said, you know, John was talking about that Honeycombs band. I think we should write a song about the drummer, Honey, because he kept going on about her. You know, Chuck really had his antenna up about stuff that we were talking about, like even at rehearsals, you know, and just bands that we were referring to and all that stuff, which I think speaks volumes about how great he is as a producer. You know, he's really zeroing in on the band that he's producing, as opposed to how can I mold this in the fashion of Chuck Prophet, you know? So anyway, but yeah, Chuck said, I think we should write a song about that Honey from the Honeycombs. So, you know, that was Chuck's idea, and we sat down, and I mean, it almost wrote itself, because it's like, you know, when you've got subject material like that, it's just, you know, can't go wrong. Other thing I want to say that was kind of a fantastic thing was that I actually have home movies, or, you know, a home movie clip of my brother opening Honeycombs 45 picture sleeve in Christmas 1964, which, you know, just he's got the little, you know, butch cut or crew cut or whatever it is. And, you know, he's got this big smile on his face, and he's unwrapping and showing the 45, you know. It was I Can't Stop by the Honeycombs, if you know that record.
Yeah, sure. Oh, well, your parents were cool.
Well, it was my sister who gave it to him, actually.
Okay.
We had an older sister who turned us on to a lot of stuff. Although my parents were cool, I got to say, because like, my mom was the one who brought, you know, the Aretha Franklin Never Loved a Man album into the house, and it was my mom who would bring, you know, like Miles Davis records into the house and turned us on to Stravinsky and lots of stuff, you know.
Let's hear this great song now. I want to remind folks that the new record is called From Home, and folks can go to Facebook and find information about what the band is up to right this second. And don't forget, if you live out in the Bay Area today, 3 p.m. at the Amoeba Store in Berkeley, California. Best of luck with the record, and this is an impossible question to answer, but you want to keep being in the Rubinus until the day you die?
I think it's probably going to be that way. Looks like it. I mean, you know, as the what's the Beatles line? You and I have memories longer than the road that's out ahead, or whatever. That's definitely the case for us.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly worse ways to go, right?
Yeah, you said it.
All right, Tommy Dunbar, thank you so much, and let's hear this number one hit from the album called From Home, Honey.
That's thinking positive. Thanks, Michael.
I saw her first on TV, pounding on a four-piece set of drums. Till then it was a mystery, I'd always wondered bandstand, counting off the numbers, laying down the time. I know it's crazy, but I just can't stop it.